It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, some schools across the country, including here in Wisconsin, are going back to virtual learning as Omicron spreads. The majority of districts still in person, though some bumping back the start date. We'll look at what schools are doing 2 years into the pandemic. First, lawmakers on Capitol Hill are planning a series of events for tomorrow's one-year anniversary of the January 6th insurrection. Some early reporting suggests it may be mainly Democrats in attendance. Meanwhile, a press conference from former President Donald Trump that was scheduled for tomorrow has now been canceled. It's a week in Washington. We'll talk about that story and more. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you remember about the attacks on the Capitol last year? Do you want to see lawmakers from both parties come together to reflect on what happened that day? What needs to be done, do you think, to make sure something like that doesn't happen again? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Lauren Gambino is a political correspondent for The Guardian U.S. Lauren, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
I want to start with a listen to Democratic Senator Brian Schatz from Hawaii on the Senate floor yesterday, remembering last year's Capitol attack.
I was here, and by I was here, I don't mean I was here in the Capitol. I mean, I was right here at this desk. And so no one needs to characterize it for me or pontificate about it or tell me what I think happened. I was right here. It wasn't theoretical. It wasn't a debate. It was a physical siege on the United States Capitol.
First of all, Lauren, this anniversary is personal for a lot of the lawmakers, their staff, and the others who were there that day. Can you talk about that a little?
Yes. I mean, this was a day that these lawmakers, you know, they fled for their lives. They didn't know exactly the extent of what was going to happen. You know, they were seeing violence all around them. I mean, this is incredibly, incredibly personal. And plenty of lawmakers, but also, you know, people who worked in the Capitol, they still bear sort of the emotional scars from that day. And certainly the police officers, many of them who defended the Capitol that day, bear physical scars from the violence. And so, you know, I think for a lot of lawmakers, it's very important to them that the memory of this day is preserved accurately. I think we're seeing and hearing, particularly among sort of right-wing conservative media, we're hearing rewrites of the day and what exactly took place, and some attempts to downplay it. Even the former President Donald Trump himself has attempted to downplay or rewrite what took place. And I think all of these efforts, what we'll hear a lot of from President Biden, Kamala Harris, the Democratic leaders in Congress, we're going to hear a lot about the day, and that is an effort to preserve the memory and preserve sort of a historical record of what took place.
What kind of things are being planned in the Capitol for that anniversary tomorrow?
So first, you'll hear from President Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris. We heard from the press secretary today that Joe Biden plans to make very clear that that Donald Trump bears, she said, singular responsibility for this event. It's unclear if he's going to call out the former president by name, but she said it would be very clear who he was talking about. So we do expect that in the morning. And then throughout the rest of the day, there will be remarks from House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. She will hold a moment of silence on the House floor. We'll also actually, I think this is an interesting event. They're going to have historians in conversation with House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, just to discuss again the importance of remembering this day so that it doesn't take place again, so that we can learn lessons from it. And then it will close with a prayer vigil on the Capitol steps. So a lot of a full day of events tomorrow.
Meanwhile, former President Trump had announced he would be making an address tomorrow in Florida that is apparently canceled now. What do we know about the back and forth on that?
Yeah, Donald Trump had come under pressure, you know, interestingly, from Republicans and conservatives like Laura Ingraham, who thought maybe it's not the best idea for Donald Trump to be holding a press conference in which he would almost certainly rail against Joe Biden, probably revive claims of false claims of the stolen election. And the idea is that, you know, that just doesn't help. Republicans don't want to spend the day being asked if they agree with Donald Trump's false memories of the day. And so he had, you know, become under a lot of pressure to pull out. And so ultimately he did cancel that press conference scheduled for January 6th and said he'd have more to say at a later rally. So certainly not the last from him, but it, we won't be hearing from him, it seems like, on January 6th, at least in the form of a press conference.
It's our weekly look at some of the top stories in national news. Lauren Gambino is with us from The Guardian US. Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Saul is with us in Stevens Point. Saul, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to point out, I'm not in favor of what happened on the 6th, absolutely the opposite. But remember that the mayor of Washington, D.C., because of the overuse of the military during some of the Black Lives Matter displays, begged them to keep the military low-key, keep them invisible. And that's one reason the military wasn't ready to move in. There were a lot of contradictory things going on at the same time.
So thanks for the call. Lauren, we have this ongoing investigation. Is that one of the angles that this House committee is still looking at, the various levels of security precautions taken or maybe not taken leading up to the 6th?
Absolutely. The security failures, I mean, it's been called failures at sort of every level. You know, what happened in D.C., well, you know, all the way up the chain is being investigated by the House Select Committee. Also, the DOJ is looking into what occurred, and then Capitol police officers as well have issued a number of different reports and analysis and given testimony as to what had happened on that day. And we actually just got a recent report from Capitol Police about their preparations going forward and what has changed and new security measures that have been enacted since. So certainly this is all a live discussion and part of this ongoing investigation.
Thanks for that call, Saul, at 800-642-1234. We'll go to Tyler next in Wausau. Tyler, hello.
Hi.
What did you want to bring up, Tyler?
So you were asking what one thing people remembered about the insurrection. And the one thing that kind of always sticks with me to this day is that there was video of Trump supporters tearing down the American flag and replacing it with Trump's MAGA flag. And it just kind of encapsulates at how far these people have, you know, gone to the right and how much they hate America.
Tyler, thanks for the call. A lot of people, Lauren, whether it's that moment or others, looking at the symbolism, the world watching these events in the capital of the United States. Is that something people are still talking about, just what this did to the world's view, to people's view of the United States?
Absolutely. I think, you know, everyone has their image from the day. You know, for me, it's that guy hanging from the Senate, from the you know, the seats in the upper chamber of the Senate. And I just think, you know, there was, these images were just so shocking. This is the seat of American government, and to see it overrun by rioters, to see the violence, to see, you know, the different flags, the Confederate flag waved in the halls of Congress. It was just very shocking. And I think it exposed, you know, a vulnerability to American democracy like we haven't seen before. And I think sort of that's the vein of the discussion that we're seeing build in on this 1 year anniversary. You know, how do we make sure our democracy is secure? How do we prevent this from happening again? Because it was just so shocking.
Before we move on from this topic, Lauren, we of course have this House committee looking at what President Trump knew, calls for him to take action throughout the 6th. We heard today from Attorney General Merrick Garland talk about an ongoing investigation, saying, quote, the Justice Department remains committed to holding all January 6th perpetrators at any level accountable under the law, whether they were present that day or otherwise criminally responsible. What are you watching for next in investigations from Congress or from the Justice Department?
Well, certainly we're looking at how close they get to Donald Trump's inner circle, to Donald Trump himself. We've heard from members of the committee that they you know, are finding more and more evidence to suggest Trump didn't take action despite being asked to on the day of that he didn't take action to stop the rioters, that he was asked by his daughter Ivanka, for example, to please intervene. And so I think I'm curious where all of these different threads lead. You know, do they ultimately lead to someone in his inner circle being referred for criminal charges or the president? You know, it's all very uncertain, possibly unlikely, but nonetheless, that's sort of where the discussion is going.
Talking to Lauren Gambino, political correspondent at The Guardian US, with us today for a weekly look at some of the top stories in Washington. Coming up, efforts by Democrats to pass a federal voting rights law. You can join in on that at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see something at the national level setting more standards that states have to abide by? Or do you think it's better for states to have more authority over how they handle elections and voting rights? Do you support more access to voting by mail? Or do you want to see that reined in? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our look at the top stories in national politics. Lauren Gambino stays with us from The Guardian U.S. Now efforts to change voting rights laws in Congress, a Democrat-led initiative. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see something pass? Do you want to see bipartisan cooperation? If it's not there, should Democrats in the Senate figure out a way over or around or through the filibuster? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Lauren, what do Democrats have on the table right now when it comes to voting rights?
They have two bills. One is called the John Lewis Act, and that would restore the Voting Rights Act, pieces of it which were gutted by a Supreme Court decision a few years ago. And then the second one is far more expansive, and that would really change the way we run elections in terms of giving setting a federal standard, if you will, for how we run elections. It would also have implications for campaign finance. It's pretty sprawling, and Democrats feel very important. They point to this new flurry of state-level laws that are sort of rolling back, restricting access to voting. Some of the expansions we saw in 2020, particularly due to the pandemic, so expansions of mail-in voting, those kind of new rules, those are being rolled back. And many of these state-level Republican lawmakers are using Donald Trump's false claims of voter fraud as sort of a basis for needing these new laws. So Democrats feel that their bill is really a response to that. But again, it does go further. And that's why there's been such strong debate in the Senate about it. Democrats have just 50 senators. They are trying to get bipartisan support. But as of right now, they certainly do not have anywhere near 10 Republican votes that they would need to overcome a filibuster. So they're more or less stuck. Senator Joe Manchin, always a key figure in the Senate, he has been working to try to find some sort of bipartisan consensus on voting rights, but so far has really not even come close to finding that middle ground. So that's kind of where they are. They're pretty stuck, but they are trying to forge ahead, and they're discussing, you know, different ways of possibly reforming the filibuster to pass this legislation.
I want to give a listen to Republican Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell on that point of Democrats making the case that laws are being eroded in states around the country. Here's a listen to him on the Senate floor today.
The American people are not buying this nonsensical talk of Jim Crow 2.0 or a voting rights crisis. Everybody apart from left-wing activists and the press understands this emperor has no clothes at all.
So doesn't sound like a lot of openness to a bipartisan compromise there from the Senate Minority Leader.
Absolutely not. We're hearing talk from Republicans about, you know, possibly being open to reforming something. You know, it's tangential. They're not really looking directly at voting rights. I think Democrats sort of know that their one way to do this is to try to find some carve out, some change, some rule change to the filibuster. in order to just pass this with 50 Democratic votes. But how? But you run into the issue of Joe Manchin and another senator, Kyrsten Sinema, who just don't want to get rid of the filibuster and are really wary of doing anything that might undermine the sort of power of the filibuster, which again requires 60 votes in the chamber.
You mentioned one idea that some conservatives might be on board with. There have been calls to reform, including from some conservative media outlets. The laws related to what happened last year on January 6th, really a ceremonial signing off on the already completed electoral college count to make it really crystal clear that, no, the vice president can't single-handedly block the election of the next president. Does it seem like there's openness to say, hey, let's lock down some clarity on that process?
Absolutely. And that's actually something that the House Select Committee, which will come out eventually with a list of legislative proposals for the Congress to consider. And that is certainly in one of the issues that they're targeting. Let's just make this language very clear so that we have no misunderstandings going forward. We want to know what the role is of the vice president, that it's ceremonial in this function, and we just do not want to have any lack of clarity there. And so I think there is an openness to reform that. But again, that isn't exactly what Democrats are focused on with their voting rights bill. That's a little separate. So, this won't satisfy Democrats' urge for voting rights reform, even if Democrats do support making that language clearer.
Talking to Lauren Gambino from The Guardian U.S., looking at some of the top stories in national politics right now, including Democratic efforts to pass some kind of voting rights reform that would apply to all states. Let's bring on a caller on that now. Liz is with us in Waukesha. Liz, hi.
Hi there. I cannot understand for the life of me why the Republican Party would not want to vote for fair and secure elections that prevent voter fraud. Why? What are they thinking? What is going on? That it sounds rather devious to me. I think every senator, every House Republican, everyone should want a fair, secure election so that the people win the president that they elected.
Liz, thanks for that call. Lauren, one argument I've seen certainly from Republicans is along the lines of, hey, elections are the state's job to run. We don't want the federal government stepping on toes. What are you hearing from Republicans as to why they don't want to pass these two packages of voting rights bills?
That's absolutely right. And they also argue that expanding access, so perhaps like expanding mail-in balloting, for example, makes it easier for a voter to commit fraud. We haven't seen any evidence of that. But nonetheless, there is this idea that making it easier to vote somehow makes it easier to commit voter fraud. And that is what many, especially at the state level, have embraced. Again, not a lot of evidence to back that up, but that is one argument. And so in their defense, they're saying, we're actually trying to guard against voter fraud, and that's what these laws do.
Thanks for that call, Liz, at 800-642-1234. Lauren, I want to look at an agenda item for Democrats in Congress that spilled over from 2021. They passed a COVID relief package early in the year, the infrastructure bill, with some Republican support later in the year. That left part three, the Build Back Better Act, a lot of social safety net stuff, climate change, and more. What is happening, or I guess maybe what is not happening with that right now?
I think that's the better question. It's kind of been left twisting in the wind. Again, we go back to Joe Manchin. He has said he does not support it, cannot support it, and will not support it in its current form. And, I think just one way to encapsulate this whole debacle that Democrats find themselves in is on this legislation, they can actually move forward. They're using a parliamentary procedure to move forward with just 50 votes, but they don't have Joe Manchin. And yesterday, Joe Manchin said he has not been talking to the president. He hasn't been in negotiations with his fellow Democrats to try to find a consensus plan he could back. And at the same time, Majority Leader Chuck Schumer and the White House were saying, oh no, we're still in negotiations with Joe Manchin. So if they can't even agree on whether they're in or out of negotiations at the moment, I think it's a very long and difficult path ahead for the Build Back Better plan.
Is anybody publicly floating either Manchin or the White House? Okay, how about this as an alternative plan? Or is that just where nothing's going on right now as far as we can see?
As far as we can tell, so there was some reporting that Joe Manchin had sort of offered like his red line to the White House, but then weeks later he went on Fox News and said he couldn't support what the White House is putting back. So it's unclear if he'll go back to that, to the drawing board, and they'll look at the offer he reportedly put forward to them several weeks ago. You know, we know where his issues are. He's got issues around the child tax credit. And so maybe that's a starting point for negotiations. Maybe they try to pare it down and just focus on climate and then come back to other pieces of the bill. If anything were to pass, it would be very, very stripped down from what it is now.
Lauren, just briefly as we wrap up, what are you watching for? What's a top story you're watching for in 2022?
Well, it's an election year. So certainly we are watching how Democrats try to hold on to their very, very thin majorities in Congress. And as of right now, it is not looking, the landscape doesn't look great for them as we just watch Democrat after Democrat retire from Congress. So that's definitely something I'm starting to keep my eye on and will be watching for the next 11 months, 10 months.
Lauren, thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
We've been talking to Lauren Gambino, political correspondent at The Guardian US. She was with us today for our weekly look at some of the top stories in national politics. Coming up after the news, we take a look at how schools in Wisconsin and around the country are handling the latest COVID surge as they return from winter break. And we're hoping to hear from you, your personal experience in your community, in your district, in your family. You can get started right now. Email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Let us know what's happening in your community, what you wish was happening in your district. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we've got a physics expert who can help turn your tough sledding into fast, frictionless fun on your next trip to a snowy hill. Now, the highly infectious Omicron variant of COVID-19 is spread across the country just as schools are coming back from winter break. Take a listen to U.S. Education Secretary Miguel Cardona on Fox News earlier this week.
You know, we've been very clear. Our expectation is for schools to be open full-time for students, for in-person learning.
The majority of districts nationwide are reopening in person, but across the country, over 3,000 schools announced that they are either going virtual to start the year or bumping back in-person school, including some districts in Wisconsin. And schools with in-person learning in many cases are trying to stay safe with widespread testing, which brings challenges of its own. We're talking about how schools are coping as the country is hit with another wave of COVID cases, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. Students, staff, teachers, and parents, we especially want to hear from you. What is happening right now in your district? Are you back in person? Were you bumped back a day or two? A little bit of virtual on the way? And what do you think of that decision, whichever one it is? What challenges are you seeing when it comes to staffing, to testing? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. John Diamond is a professor of sociology and education policy at Brown University, a former professor at UW-Madison. He's co-author of Despite the Best Intentions, How Racial Inequality Thrives in Good Schools. John, welcome back to Central Time.
Oh, thanks so much. I'm glad to be here.
Well, you have your eye here in Wisconsin still, I think. What are we seeing in Wisconsin schools when it comes to this decision of opening day coming out of the winter break?
Yeah, I mean, I think Wisconsin is dealing with the similar issues to the rest of the country with the Omicron variant spreading so quickly. I know both Madison and Milwaukee have put a pause on starting up in-person instruction and gone virtual for a short period of time. And I think it's, you know, largely because we're dealing with a situation where we don't really have many good choices. I think schools are dealing with, you know, at least three issues simultaneously. It's the pandemic itself and the health consequences of it. It's, you know, what that does for the daily routines of schools. And then there are the politics that have made things even more difficult to deal with. So I think we're dealing with those health concerns, those regular routines being disrupted and having to adapt in the moment. And then there are the political dynamics that play themselves out in the context of schools in ways that are not always helpful.
Let's look at one aspect of that disruption routine, and that's staffing. We heard from Jim, who wrote on a WPR.org article, a comment section. He wrote, lack of substitute teachers is what forces school districts to go virtual. Jim says, I substitute in two districts in southeastern Wisconsin with a surge in cases. I've made the choice to quit exposing myself to the rampant spread of COVID. Fewer subs are willing to expose themselves to getting sick from COVID for the $100 to $120 bucks a day that most districts pay. Substitute teachers, we see the Cap Times reports the Madison School District having a record number of positive tests for staff over the last couple of weeks. How big a problem, John, is it just to have people in the schools to do the job?
Yeah, it's a very big problem. And I think that's one reason that schools are making the decision to go virtual temporarily. I mean, what happens when there is one case in a school and that one person has contact with several people? You know, that means that you have to have a response. When one person gets COVID and one teacher gets COVID and they're out, and many people have been exposed, you run into the challenge of people having to sort of quarantine or isolate themselves. And that's one of the reasons that the CDC recently reduced the number of days that people needed to be out of work or recommended to be out of work, because with the number of cases we're getting with Omicron, it's almost as if we quarantine for 10 days, the society will shut down, right? And schools are no different. So as this person has said, you know, coming to school, putting yourself at risk, and also putting others at risk is a choice that some people don't want to make. And that's in some ways, we've seen that happen in some of the major school districts in Chicago, New York, where there's conflict between the teachers union and district management leadership, because teachers are concerned about being in these situations where their health is placed at risk and other people who are not obligated to be in school, substitute teachers, may make other decisions. So it's a fundamental problem for us to deal with.
You also mentioned the politics surrounding this here in Wisconsin. We have one likely Republican challenger for governor taking out an ad this week pointing toward the Madison and Milwaukee delays, saying, you know, they're attacking that idea, saying as governor, she wouldn't allow schools to do this. Could you talk about how much that that idea that politicians are looking over their shoulders is influencing school district decision making?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that happens in states like Wisconsin is you have competing ideas and competing ideologies that are coming into play. But I think one of the things we really have to pay attention to is we really need to be focused on the science. What is the science telling us about the consequences of closing and the consequences of staying open? And what we have too often is people playing politics with those decisions. For example, even having conversations about masking, social distancing, and vaccines has become a highly politicized set of issues, when in reality, we know that masks work, that masks can be protective, and that high quality masks can really mitigate the spread of COVID. We know that vaccines keep people out of the hospital. We know that they keep people from dying from COVID. But we have these contentious arguments and debates about vaccinations. And this is something that has traditionally been a debate that happens around vaccinations amongst a subset of the population. Most people to go to school had to be vaccinated against certain conditions and diseases. And so in the contemporary context, given the way that things started at the beginning of the pandemic and the sort of deeply polarized country that we live in, we can't even make decisions that are scientifically based without people spreading misinformation and creating arguments that are largely across party lines, Democrat and Republican.
This reminds me of the last time I talked to you about these issues. I think it was back in 2020, this lose-lose thing where, yes, being in person in schools is not risk-free. There are risks and consequences there. not being in schools. There are risks and consequences to learning, maybe to social well-being for kids. How do we balance those two things out?
I mean, I think we have to have a discussion and conversation that is rooted in the best evidence that we have, right? We know that young people can go to school relatively safely with the proper mitigation strategies in place. The problem is when we try to put those mitigation strategies in place, they've turned board meetings into contentious battles over things like masking, right? And we also know that when young people are at home, there are some deleterious consequences that can happen. So the best thing for us to do, in my estimation, is to take the science seriously, try to figure out when it is prudent to keep young people away from school, which I actually think is prudent at this moment with the spread of Omicron, to keep people out of school temporarily because of the consequences of a spread in cases and what that means for disruptions that could be longer term. But we also just really have to attend to how do we do it safely and for people to go along with those mitigation strategies that are most effective.
Talking to John Diamond, professor of sociology and education policy at Brown University, looking at schools, a new beginning for the school year, coming back from winter break amid the Omicron outbreak, and some schools putting off in person for a couple of days, maybe more, a little bit of virtual, a lot of schools going in person, trying to get testing. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think schools should do, especially maybe in your local area? If you have a stake in this as a student, parent, teacher, administrator, love to hear from you at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. John, I know a concern you have is of unequal outcomes in schools, even in normal times when it comes to things like resources for schools. Are we paying enough attention to how particular districts, maybe in some of these big city districts we've been talking about, are affected by resources when it comes to dealing with this latest COVID surge?
Yeah, I mean, I think what COVID has done is it's shown a light on many of our cleavages in our society and social class inequality, racial inequality, and other forms of inequality have in some ways been exacerbated by the pandemic. And so it is important for us to pay attention to those things. There's been a lot of discussion about the loss of learning that happens for young people who aren't in school and how the consequences of that are greater for young people whose families are not wealthy, for young people in certain communities. So I do think it's really important for us to pay attention to those issues of inequality. But I will continue to say that, you know, I still believe that young people are resilient. I still believe that the loss of a few days of school or some period of school can be overcome. But the health consequences, I think, need to really be driving our decision making as much as possible. And we need to sort of create more effort to address the sort of inequalities that emerge. But I think the health consequences are really important for us to consider. And I also would just add to that, that I think we've, you know, unfortunately seen a failure in a number of ways in our society as a whole. First, to take the pandemic seriously. Second, to do the things that we needed to do to sort of mitigate the consequences. And most recently, to not allow our politics to overwhelm our common sense around some of the critical issues that we need to be addressing. So I think we, you know, kind of need a reset. In some ways, we need to understand what we need to move forward. And that means across the federal, state, local levels, and our individual decisions, we need to be figuring out how do we move forward from this as opposed to continue to cycle in a negative direction.
Talking to John Diamond from Brown University, looking at how schools are coping with the Omicron surge just after winter break. Some putting off reopening, most going back as scheduled. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Should schools be open this week for in-person learning? What's been your biggest challenge in the last 2 years? The schools have gone back and forth between in-person and virtual learning. If you're a parent, what do you want to see happen? Has your district bumped back a couple days? What's that meant for your schedule, your work, your childcare? If you work in a school, do you want to be there? If you're one of those substitute teachers, are you maybe not taking those jobs for a week or two. Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up our talk with John Diamond, professor of sociology and education policy at Brown University, talking with us about schools coping with another COVID surge, with leaders, including President Biden, pushing in-person learning, some districts delaying reopening, starting off with a couple of virtual days along the way. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email ideas@WPR.org. Especially love to hear from parents, students, staff at schools, what you're seeing, what you wish you were seeing. Let's go to your calls now. Rebecca is with us in Manitowoc. Rebecca, hi.
Yes, hello. I just wanted to comment or just offer some insight, I guess, on just the damage that's done when kids are kept home, because I have two children. Last year during the shutdown, we're both in high school, and when the school shut down and they became virtual learners, their grades suffered, and one of them actually became very depressed and suicidal, and we had to start counseling. And these are both straight-A students. Both my kids were straight-A scholarship students and were failing classes because that social life that they rely so heavily on just disappeared overnight. They're both in extracurriculars and sports, and everything that they hold dear and love disappears overnight. And I think, you know, the discussion is always about the grade school children, but let's talk about the high school children and what happens to them when we shut down classes. Most of these kids are close to adulthood. Most of them are vaccinated. Let's not shut down the schools and let's leave it up to, you know, masking and distancing and those sort of things, because I think it's way more damaging.
Rebecca, thank you so much for sharing that story. Best to your kids. Hope they've bounced back from that. John, what do you think? Mental health concerns, social and grade concerns from Rebecca and her kids.
Yeah, I think Rebecca's comments are really important to keep in mind. And there are consequences for young people who are out of school. And I know some students suffer academically. My own son actually did well being out and thrived in certain ways, but I know many young people had serious struggles being at home, and the mental health consequences I think are important to keep in mind. I think we've all had some mental health consequences, even though we may not always acknowledge it. But I think another point that Rebecca made is really important, that we need to make sure that we're making in-person learning as safe as possible. We've had sort of a fundamental failure in getting testing, making testing available. We've had challenges getting people to do things like wear masks. We've had other kinds of challenges around, she mentioned vaccination, around getting enough people vaccinated to sort of keep the spread down. So I think, yes, we need to be aware of what's lost when young people are out of school, but we need to do the things to make it possible for them to be there as well.
Rebecca, thanks again for sharing your experience. We'll go now to Lauren in Madison. Lauren, hello.
Hi. I'm wondering, from Dr. Diamond's research, if he's done any research during these times around some of the effects of students, vulnerable students who, when schools are closed and parents have to go to work, what happens to those students, and do the health effects of going to school, is that worse than students who are left home alone without?
Lauren, thanks for the call. So kids who are at risk, who are home alone, John, instead of being at school.
Right. I mean, there is good research that sort of speaks to what happens to young people when they're at home. And, you know, those young people who are at home, who have substantial resources and may even have a parent who's home and can sort of help them with school, are definitely at an advantage. And those young people who don't have those things, there need to be some things put in place to make sure that they're not at home and vulnerable. I mean, it speaks to larger issues and problems with regard to the sort of safety net that we have, the vulnerability of a lot of families in terms of having those additional resources, the ways we provided support for people who are out of work or struggling financially. So there are bigger issues that are driving these challenges. But I think, you know, the comments that people are making do point to the fact that we're in a situation where we don't have a lot of good choices. And I think what that means is we need to be as clear-headed as possible about how to make the damage, how to reduce the damage as much as possible, as opposed to arguing all or nothing, one or the other, or falling back on political ideology.
Thanks again for that call at 800-642-1234. Patty joins us now in Birchwood. Patty, hi.
Hi. I appreciate this discussion. Absolutely agreed. This pandemic has shown us how little we have regard for a social safety net. I'm a substitute teacher up in Birchwood. I would love to go back, but the school district doesn't require masks, and it doesn't require their people to be vaccinated. And so I won't go back because I also work another job and I don't want to spread it. And my concern is that it seems to be that the people in authority are kowtowing to the biggest bully in the room. The politics is the people that are yelling and screaming and making death threats. And I really think in order to not have a civil war, authority at all levels of government are just caving. And that really, really scares me.
Patty, thanks for sharing your experience as a substitute teacher. John, do you see what she's seeing, school districts caving to the loudest voices?
Yeah, I mean, I think I do. And I think there are some things that, you know, leadership sometimes means that you have to go against what the loudest voices are saying, right? But we don't really see that at the federal level, and we don't necessarily see it at the state level. Instead, we see, I think, people trying to score political points to make the other side angry, fall back on political ideology, as I've said before. And I think sometimes leadership means you have to step forward and do what's best for young people, as opposed to doing what is best for one's political gain or one's own position as a leader, for example. But I think the points that she raised are vital for us to pay attention to.
Thanks a lot for that call. In our last just over a minute now, John, can you paint us a picture of what you see as the ideal right now, this first school week of January, of how a school is going to handle this?
I mean, I think it depends on the school context. I feel like every school should require masks because we know they work. I think the federal government needs to, and others need to sort of make testing more readily available. But for schools, I think they do need to decide what's best in their local context. And I think all of the mitigation strategies need to be in place that are reasonable to make sure that the spread doesn't get out of control. Because what winds up happening is you start getting a spread of cases and basically nothing can work. So in places where there's a concern about cases spreading really quickly, I think it makes sense to take a quick hiatus to go virtual. And then hopefully in the next 2 to 3 weeks, opening up will make more sense and be a more viable option.
And just briefly, do you have any hope that the, the political temperature will dial down a little bit on this?
I wish it would. I'm not completely optimistic because the folks at the highest level of government don't seem to be interested in governing. And that sort of trickles down and it affects all of the levels of government and all of our individual lives.
John, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you so much.
John Diamond is a professor of sociology and education policy at Brown University, formerly with UW-Madison, co-author of Despite the Best Intentions, How Racial Inequality Thrives in Good Schools. He joined us today for a look at schools reopening or delaying reopening in some cases during this latest COVID surge. Still time for you to share your thoughts, your experiences in schools right now. You can email ideas@WPR.org, tweet us @CentralTimeWPR, and of course, follow reporting over at WPR.org. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show, rural hospitals have been hit hard during these COVID-19 surges. Find out how they deal with the challenges and share maybe your own experiences. That's tomorrow morning at 7, and that's coming up here on the Ideas Network. Meet the new dog, different than the old dog. Two new dogs, actually. The American Kennel Club announced yesterday that we'll recognize two new breeds of dogs. There's the Russian Toy and the Moody. That's M-U-D-I. They're both pretty rare at this point. There are fewer than 800 Russian Toys in the U.S. and about 450 of the Moody here in the country. They describe the Russian Toy as small and loving. In dog competitions, it would be in the toy category. Makes sense. The Moody is active, medium-sized, and part of the herding category. Upon seeing pictures of the dogs from the AKC, an informed source describes both breeds as adorable. Teaching new dogs old tricks, this is Central Time.